Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com, or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. On Fast Forward Radio and at The Speculist, we talk about what's happening in the world today. We talk about where the world is going, what the future is likely to shape up to be, and we're not afraid to take a pretty contrarian view about that. To wit, we believe that the world is getting better all the time. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, you're not paying attention, and we believe that something's going to happen. Something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Oh, I'm doing great. Doing great.
I had a new answer. I had a new answer I wanted to try. I was going to
Let me ask again. Phil, how are you?
Again. Yeah. You know, I'm on the road to perfection, but I think I'm taking the scenic route.
I like that. That's good. I'm doing pretty good. Man, you talk about a beautiful day in Louisiana today. I think it's probably the prettiest day of the year. And it's just gorgeous all day. I'm having a great weekend.
Autumn is nice in Colorado. I guess, you know, it's just a special season all around. So it's nice in Louisiana too. Huh? Prior to the leaves changing, that probably doesn't come for another few weeks, or does that happen at all where you are?
Yeah, it happens, and we are probably a good month away from that. But it's temperature's nice. It's not too hot, and I mean it's. You know, it's hot most of the year here in Louisiana, but it's beautiful. It's and we just had a good time being outside with the kids all day today, so it was nice.
Oh, outstanding! Yeah, we supposedly this was the prime weekend for driving your car up into the mountains and looking at the aspens. This is a thing people in Colorado do because the aspens change and they do it over a very brief period of time. So there's this window, and there's usually just one weekend when it's the best. To drive up and take a look at the aspens, and we have with us on the line also our chat host Michael Darling, and we can just check in with him. Michael, did you get up to look at the aspens this weekend by any chance?
I had to do that vicariously through my wife. She was up in the mountains this weekend. I was home moving big pieces of rock and dirt with my two boys.
Well, y'all gonna have to explain that to me. Because I'm thinking these are evergreen trees. How? You know, why is this a special weekend?
Aspens are deciduous. They're
okay.
You need to come out and spend some time looking at the trees because the aspen trees are actually these very delicate trees. They have these kind of rounded leaves. They're beautiful, beautiful little trees. And they're actually one thing that's interesting about a grove of aspen trees is that all the trees that you see, they're actually one organism. They're connected at the roots. So, in fact, Michael, you can correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm veering from an astounding science fact into a tale of the paranormal, but I believe I have read that all the aspen trees in the entire Rocky Mountain Range are one organism. Have you heard that?
That would be an overstatement of the fact.
Okay.
The way it works is this. Aspens can propagate two ways. They can spread their seed, so to speak, and they can propagate by clone. And when they propagate by clone, the roots spread out in a very shallow but wide lateral network. And where they hit the surface and the conditions are right, a new tree will sprout out of that root. Well, that's a clone of the original, and they share the same root structure.
Oh, okay.
And
they're
not
all connected.
That's right. Not every single one. The largest living organism, depending on how you define it, if you define it as one thing with the same DNA, is an aspen grove in Utah that covers, I don't know, 2,300 square miles or something. I'm trying to look it up. But it's because as the roots spread laterally and then pop up, a new tree forms. and to get back to the why the fall colors become what they are, fall comes slightly sooner at the higher elevations than it does down here. So down here, I don't know, today was 81 degrees and everything is still green, and there's a little color starting to show up in some of the early turning trees. But in the mountains, it's like everything went from whatever it used to be to now having the aspens be orange and yellow.
Right, and it's quite spectacular when you come upon a grove of them up there. Well, that's thanks for
that's cool. We'll have to get a picture up in the show notes of aspens in the process of changing. That'd be awesome.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I'll locate one because it is quite a sight to see. Of course, it's a little bit offset since we're on this subject now. And one of the reasons that Soraya and I did not go today is there's a terrible pestilence, a beetle, which has infested a lot of the evergreen trees up in the mountains. And so you'll see these glorious vistas of aspen trees, but you'll also see these very disheartening vistas of evergreen trees that have been killed by this. I think it's a beetle. Is that right, Michael?
It is a beetle, and what ends up happening is the evergreenness, the green of the needles turns to brown as the tree becomes infected, and it's sort of from a distance, when you look at a ridge and there's trees everywhere and there's all these evergreens marching up the ridge, it looks like a wave of this rust just marching up through these trees, but it's really,
yeah,
you know, death.
It's quite dramatic, but not in a happy way, the way the aspens are. Well, that's Michael Darling.
Right.
He's our chat host and mountain fauna expert, actually. Excuse me, flora. We'll have to get the fauna on another occasion.
That's Headley.
But this I'm sorry. I wish I wouldn't talk over you when you say that. We're going to be getting into our topic this evening, which is the world getting better all the time. We spent some time last week talking about that. That's a regular feature on The Speculus, Better All the Time, where we take good news stories and we tie them together because we think that positive developments tie into our overall theme of just kind of this improvement of the planet, the improvement of the human condition. But Stephen, I understand that you have a story that runs square against the Better All the Time hypothesis. Something
okay
that happened to you this weekend.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Just it's almost an embarrassing thing. What I'm doing is I take my kids to school. Two of my children, I take to school, and my wife takes the other kids in the opposite direction to a different school. So anyway, I'm loading up my kindergartner, and so he's having trouble climbing up in my vehicle. And so I put down my laptop right next to my car. I help him get in. I get him all buckled in and everything. Yeah, he's safe. I slam the door. I get in the driver's seat, slam my door, and take off to take them to school, and right over the top of my laptop. And
wow.
And so, of course, it smashed the screen of the laptop. I'm actually, believe it or not, running the show off that laptop, hooked to a external monitor. So
wow.
I guess my laptop has become a desktop.
but that's pretty good. I mean, the fact that you're still using it, I mean, I would have thought that it would be just totally wrecked. And what you're saying is the computer functions fine. It was
yeah.
just really the laptop monitor that got hosed.
That's right. That's right. And so, I'm not out any data. I'm in good shape on that. And so, yeah, hardly a tragedy. I just got to go get another laptop. So not a big deal.
I still think this... You know, it's not as funny, but I think this tops me driving my bike into my garage roof, I think.
Well, yours is just a more humorous picture, I think, Phil. So I mean,
yeah, you know, running over one's laptop is something we all dread that we're going to do eventually one of these days. But
well, you know, since you fixed your bike rack, I guess now I've got to go figure out a way to fix this laptop monitor, right, and get it reattached.
Well, if the bike, let me tell you, if the bike rack is any indication, okay, if you can take an example from the bike rack and apply it to the laptop, what you need to do is get some vice grips and hook that laptop to a ladder or another straight surface and then just start wailing on it with a hammer.
Okay, that'll fix it right away, huh?
Well, that worked. Hey, it worked for the bike rack is all I'm saying. I don't know.
Well, you should see this monitor. Believe it or not, the monitor is still, you know, is still functioning. I mean, it's on, and in the top left corner, I can see a little bit of the screen, But the rest of it is just, I mean, I've got this, you know, like a spider web of smashed black and white color. I like kind of a, and sort of a rainbow pattern in here, too. So, anyway, it's
well, the good news here is, obviously, the better all the time thing is they're making laptops better. You can run over them now and still host your show on Sunday evening. So.
Yeah, I guess so.
See, I thought the happy ending was going to be, well, you'll just get a new laptop, and of course, Moore's Law.
It'll be a better laptop.
Your new laptop will be more powerful than the previous. So.
That's right.
So
or cheaper, one or the other.
Well, you're coming out ahead. Anyway,
that's
you
right.
Want to look at it. You know, except for the money you're out buying the new laptop. But hey, I can't solve all your problems. Okay, I'm just doing my best. Now, so let's find some more positive stories. I'm going to start with one. And we'll be looking for contributions from callers. If you'd like to join us, you can call us at 347-215-8972 or participants in the chat room. Anyone who has an idea for a good news story to include in the next Better All the Time. But I've got one. This is actually an update on one we did in Better All the Time number 30, which would have been like November of last year. And the headline was Stem Cells from Skin Cells. And I believe, Stephen, that when I wrote that, I was actually linking a blog post that you had put up on The Speculist.
That's right. That's right. And I'd said this is great because, you know, there's a political controversy over stem cell research, basically because most of these stem cells have been harvested from embryos, which and this required usually the destruction of an embryo. Now they had figured out a way to actually harvest a stem cell line from an embryo and keep the embryo from dying. They've done that, and now they figured out ways to turn adult stem cells into these embryonic stem cells or embryonic equivalents. And so, yeah, that was. And how long ago was it when we published that, Phil?
Well, it would have been around November of last year, so not even
okay.
A year ago.
Yeah, and so. And we got this huge new revolutionary improvement of that process now.
Exactly. Well, I was thinking as I looked back over that post how interesting a set of developments that news was last November from when we first started talking about this subject. I had done some posts on the subject, which eventually turned into a series of posts called The Tiresome Argument because I was looking for alternative models for how we might come up with pluripotent embryonic type stem cells without actually creating embryos that had to be killed. And one of my ideas was maybe there was a way of using cloning technology to produce something that was not quite a human embryo, but that would produce those kinds of cells. And if you'll recall, there was this is probably 4 or 5 years ago. This is early days, and it got picked up by a couple of very, very opposed people who are very opposed to that line of research to embryonic stem cells and who kind of threw me in with advocates of that. And I got accused of being, an advocate of slavery and of being kind of a Frankenstein monster kind of a guy, kind of a Hitler type figure. It was kind of nasty. But
Godwin's law was broken.
Yeah. Godwin's law was broken reasonably early on in the discussion, too. I have to say, and the anger seemed to come from the fact that these guys were saying, "What you're talking about is nonsense. There's only one way to get these cells. It's from killing an embryo. There's not going to be any other way of getting them, and this is something that just needs to be completely abandoned for ethical reasons."
Right.
There are a lot of different views on whether or not. And how human embryos should be used for research, but those guys took it too far. Okay, they took it too far by saying this will never happen.
I took some heat from the opposite side on this, Phil.
That's interesting. How was that? How so?
Well, I had published before this development last November of being able to take adult stem cells adult skin cells or adult cells and turn them into embryonic equivalents. Before that, I had written a post basically saying, we're going to be able to do this,
right.
Arguing that this is going to happen. and therefore it's going to. And once it does happen, the whole this whole political, you know, argument will be moot. We won't have to worry about it, and that, you know, and you know, we can all go back to holding hands and singing Kumbaya. There's no Nazis.
Right, yeah.
No Nazis. And there's a particular blogger who, if I named his name, you would recognize immediately, who wrote back and said, "Well, you're just being foolish. We've got to be dogmatic about." Well, he didn't use the that, he didn't say it that way, but what he meant was, we've got
to
be dogmatic about
it. He didn't have to use the word, right? I mean, obviously that's where he's coming from, right?
Right. We need these embryonic stem cells, and we need them now so that we can do this research. And if you don't toe that line, then you're obviously anti-science. So, anyway, which is,
so
I guess, not as bad as being a Nazi, Phil. So,
well, you know, I feel that's great that we both got beat up, and we got beat up from the opposite ideological sides of the spectrum for saying essentially the same thing.
Right.
Right.
Maybe we were in the right place. When you're taking heat from both sides, maybe you are where you need to be. I hope we are.
Well, my take is, I mean, and this is just part of the beauty of the human imperative view of the world, of the accelerating change, better all the time view of the world, is that technology and progress enable us to transcend ideology. A lot of the absolutes that people who get into political debates rely on to define who they are and who the other is and why they're right and why they're wrong, a lot of those things, I'm not saying everything, I'm not saying there's no actual right and wrong, that's the last thing in the world I would argue, but a lot of those things can be overcome by introducing new categories and introducing new options and new alternatives. And this is just, you know, a fantastic example of how that can work and how that, in fact, has worked. Because by the time you put that story out, stem cells from skin cells is how I described it on Better All the Time. I don't remember what the actual headline that you put up was. You know, this thing that a group of people said would never happen, and so we shouldn't talk about it. And the other group of people said will slow us down, I guess, right, if we focus on that rather than focus on the embryonic stem cells. That was their argument to you?
Right.
Yeah.
That'll take the steam out of our argument on our side. Don't talk about the possibility of being able to make embryonic equivalents from something else. We may not ever get to that point, and therefore we have to have embryonic stem cells, so we have to be dogmatic about it.
Right. So this development comes along, and it kind of ruins everybody's good time of being virtuous and pure and good and making the other guys the bad guys, which is great. And the latest development on this is it turns out that the first generation of these stem cells that they created using adult cells, it was created using a retrovirus, and they used that to insert what they call the four transcription factors into the skin cells that were used to create the stem cells. And I'm reading here from the story. It says, because a retrovirus, by definition, inserts itself permanently into its host DNA, this ensured that the transcription factors were transferred, but also led to the propagation of the virus itself. So this was a effective process, but a highly flawed process, because it had this virus kind of carried along as baggage with the creation of the stem cells. And it says, furthermore, since the virus confers self-renewal capabilities to its new host cell, many believe that the retrovirus might be required for iPS cells to reproduce. However, this new research shows that a different type of virus, called an adenovirus, can make the transfer in mouse cells without permanently integrating itself. So what we're talking about is it was a huge step forward to use a virus to do this in the first place, to achieve this result. But there was a roadblock, and the big roadblock was, we're carrying a virus along with the baggage. That's not good. And now we found a virus that can do it. It does its work, and then it goes away. And so now I think we're really on track to seeing, I think, probably reasonably widespread implementation of individuals having their own embryonic stem cells. They're not really embryonic. We should use the correct technical term, pluripotent stem cells produced from their their mature tissues. And at that point,
and that was my other point. Why this is even better. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. You were saying?
That was the other point. I mean, this is better than embryonic stem cells because why would an embryonic stem cell be less than perfect? Because it's of an embryo that's not you, unless I suppose
right.
I cloned you and then took the embryonic stem cell. This way, I mean, you have a pluripotent stem cell that it's made from you, and so it can be used to fix you, and without problems of rejection.
It's got your DNA. That's
right.
That's the bottom line. The tissues it produces are genetically part of your body, which would not be the case using stem cells, as you point out, harvested from some other embryo, unless that embryo happened to be, which was my original idea, some kind of clone, or, I was looking for a not actual clone alternative to cloning. Although apparently we don't have to take that step to get the DNA match. You can take your skin cells and you can produce now pluripotent stem cells, which can the possibilities here are just about endless. It seems to me once these are being produced in a large scale, we're going to see not only treatments for diseases, but I think probably all kinds of cosmetic applications for this, probably treatments for injury. I can just imagine people having their, as you get older, sports injuries, knees and things like that repaired using this technology. It seems to me there's just an almost limitless range of applications of this technology, and we're getting much closer to it. We were getting closer to it in November last year, and now here we are getting even closer with this development.
All right. It's exciting. That's a big deal. And it will become
one.
A much bigger deal as time goes by and it gets cheap enough to where it can actually be used on individuals and not just in the lab.
Exactly. So what do you got for us, Stephen? You got a good news
story? Well, I'm going to go with a funny one. Let's do one that's funny. Apple iPhone is offering an application for people who believe that the iPhone is just, it's much too bourgeois now. I mean, everyone can get one. If you're one of these people that really, your self-worth is based on having something that somebody else doesn't have, then here's what you need to do. Go to the Apple iPhone store and buy for $1,000 a screensaver that says, "I'm rich." It has a glowing red gem on it, and that's all it does. It's just a glowing red gem, and so when you pull out your iPhone, it's got a glowing red gem and the message, "I'm rich." So.
I'm rich, and you can't wait. So you've paid $1,000 for this, and it's just a
right.
status symbol. I mean, you
that's
you
all
that
it
around,
is.
People go,
that's right. I suppose.
Super
if you if,
who paid $1,000 to.
Yeah, it seems to me that it also communicates another message. I'm stupid, but.
or I don't know what to do with my money. Yeah.
Yes, please help me spend my money. I have more money than I have since. So anyway, I thought it was hilarious. So I suppose that is one way the world is getting better all the time. There are ways to spend your money if it's burning a hole in your pocket.
Wow. Well, that is a I see in the chat room. Michael suggests "I'm drunk" is another possible reading of that. Yeah, I think that's good.
That reminds me of the punchline of a joke, but it's very sexist, so I cannot repeat it here.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks for bringing it up then. But,
yeah. Sorry, I couldn't complete the joke. Oh, boy.
No, it's all right. I would guess that it's just a matter of time before somebody hacks this or somebody creates a 99-cent version of the same thing, right? I mean,
that's
right. And it'll blow the market away for this, right? I mean, it'll look just like it. It'll say, "I am rich," and it'll have a little jewel, and you paid $1 for it instead of $1,000. Then the people who paid the $1,000 are going to feel
even stupider.
Well, yeah. Well, they got the hangover for one thing, and then.
I got a much better one. Let's.
Okay.
That was my unserious better all the time. Here's
okay.
A serious one.
You
About an hour and a half ago, SpaceX confirmed that the Falcon 1 reached orbit. And it makes it the first privately developed all-liquid-fuel rocket to achieve orbit. And it's you know, this is a success for the private space industry and a big deal for those of us who are following it.
That is outstanding. So SpaceX, catch us up. They're like Virgin Galactic. They're an upcoming, up-and-coming, would-be private.
That's right. But they're more interested in satellite launches. They're not interested,
right.
I don't believe, in putting people in orbit. They're wanting to be a firm that gets paid for putting satellites in orbit.
Right.
They had had some other attempts at this. This is I think the third time that they've tried, and this time they succeeded.
So, and I'm sorry, what did they accomplish today? They got something into orbit, or
that's right,
a successful suborbital.
Falcon 1 reached orbit, and it was a stable orbit, and they're super pumped. And as a matter of fact, I'll see if I can get the link. I'll go ahead and put it in the chat. And it'll certainly be in the show notes.
It's amazing. You think about there was a time when only one country in the world ever put anything into orbit, and then that number doubled. And for the longest time, it was just those two countries who could put something into orbit, and then that got vastly expanded, although a lot of the people, a lot of the different governments who were putting, or countries who were putting things into orbit were using the technology from one of those two countries. And now you have something where you're not talking about a country doing it, you're talking about a company doing it.
That's right.
It's amazing that the distribution of that technology from the state level to the private enterprise level. And I'll tell you another story that is similar to that we saw this weekend. The Taikonauts that China launched into space, I guess it was on Friday evening, flew up into orbit and completed a spacewalk. And
that's
You could do a similar analysis of, you know, who are all the countries who've ever sent a craft into space and had people get out of it and walk in space, right? I mean, that's a very small number. And now China,
I think it was just two countries prior to this week. It was two. Now it's three.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Now it's three. So you see it. You see this capability passing to new players, additional states, and also, you know, kind of being pushed down the food chain into private enterprise. And, you know, I'm hoping that eventually individuals, right, will be able to enjoy that kind of technology. That's what I'm looking forward to.
Well, if the Chinese are right, then it's quite possible that it could happen for individuals. Did you catch this one, Phil, that they're trying to develop the British M drive? There's a British scientist came up with the theory behind it a few years back. Critics have pounded him for it, saying it's not technically possible.
You were asking whether I've caught that.
Whether you've been following the story.
I'm going to let you off the hook because I know you ran over your laptop. I've actually put a blog post on the Speculist about this yesterday.
Okay. All right. Well, I can't read it if my laptop is smashed, Phil.
Yeah. Short answer, yes, I have been following it. Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead, describe it. Yeah.
Well, the M drive is it's a microwave. Device, similar to what you got in your oven, I suppose, but more powerful. Basically they fill a copper container in such a way that it's that it pushes something forward through space. Now, the reason that scientists have pounded on these guys for this is that they're calling it a reactionless drive. The critics are saying that, the microwaves are not exiting the engine. There's nothing pushing away from the ship, allowing the ship to move forward. You're not losing any particles behind. Which would obviously be one of the big benefits from this is that you don't have to carry all the fuel with you. As long as you've got electricity and you can make microwaves, then you can move through space. How would you go forward with this, Phil? I mean, apparently the guy in. Go ahead.
Yeah. What's cool about this is Roger Scheuer, British scientist, came up with this idea. This reminds me a lot of black light. You know, we talked about this black light energy production methodology that this scientist has developed, and he's got backers, and people are trying to make it happen, and most of the scientific community says it'll never work. Well, that's the same thing is true with this M-drive. The conventional scientific response is, this is poppycock, it can't work, it violates the laws of physics, it'll never happen.
It's a little like the Lorax. It's a little like the Lorax picking himself up at the end of that Dr. Seuss story, and flying away.
Yeah.
You know, because there's nothing pushing the vehicle forward or causing it to levitate or whatever. There's nothing exiting the vehicle to push it forward. Well, the developer of this is saying, well, the reason this works is because of the relativity effects, I guess, because these particles are traveling at near the speed of light, because they're bouncing off one part of the drive at a different time than the other, and somehow if you have it focused to where it's actually pushing one part of the drive panel more often than the other, then it's going to push it in a certain direction. I'm not smart enough to follow that, to be quite honest. So I hope that he's right. I mean, wouldn't it be cool? I mean, here's your flying car right there, you know.
Well, yeah, you would think. The bottom line to me on this one is that I agree. I can't evaluate it either. The experts say it can't work.
Right.
A few scientists are persuaded otherwise, and what's, to me, exciting about this is that it's being tried, kind of like with blacklight. You know, there was a time when if an idea was preposterous and couldn't work, resources couldn't be dedicated to that. We live in an age when we can take some long shots, and we did a couple of shows about long shot futures. The M-Drive, I have to classify that, when I wrote about it in the blog, I do classify it as kind of a long shot, as is blacklight power production. But boy, one of these long shots is going to pay off one of these days, and it's going to be, what's the term we like to use? Freaking huge.
That's right.
It's going to be enormous. So this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about news that proves the world is getting better all the time, and we're going to look at a few more of those stories and maybe take a few minutes to consider the contra case, the case that those who disagree that the world's getting better all the time might make. If you'd like to join our conversation, we've got online chat occurring right now, or you can give us a call at 347-215-8972. So
we have three sizes. We, not so we, and friggin' huge!
Okay, sorry, Phil.
that is descriptive not only of the Fast Forward Radio coffee mug that some lucky listener is going to win this week based on their Better All the Time contribution, but also the payoff for one of these big long-shot futures when one of them finally does come true. If you work on the obvious things, okay, you get some we improvement. You work on the less obvious things, it's not so we, and then there's things like the M-Drive, right? I think that's going to get...
It'll be friggin' huge if it happens.
That's going to be freaking
and,
huge.
And the other cool thing is it's the American taxpayers not having to cover it. It's the Chinese are doing it, so...
It's distributed. That's right. That's even better. Well, and interestingly, Blacklight's not being paid for by the taxpayers either. That one is privately funded. It's a business. So
yeah.
All kinds of good news associated with these. Now, Michael, I'm going to ask you what's going on in the chat room. Do we have any entries so far for good news from our chat room participants? Or if any of you are listening right now and you want to type one in real fast, that would be great.
Not directly. I will point out that it turns out in the world of large dump trucks, there is some controversy over whether or not the Cat 970B or the Komatsu 930E are which one is actually the biggest dump truck in the world. You know, and that's an indirect thing because the ability to make a gigantically huge dump truck that can move more than the previous generation of dump trucks is, if nothing else, it's cool. I don't know that it's getting better all the time, but it's a cool thing.
Well, I'm looking forward to a Mecca.
I'm sorry, a what?
A Mecca. You know what I'm talking about, Phil. A giant robot that can move things around. You know.
Like Gundam Mecha. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We'll leave the truck paradigm behind because we're gonna have big humanoid robots that just walk around and pick stuff up and carry it where it needs to go. Right.
And they can fly.
Windows
can fly.
So
that's good.
Yeah, you'll need an M drive. You'll need a working M drive for that. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be cool. We won't have cars. We won't have flying cars. We'll just each have our own Mecca. We just get in it, and it walks us around when we're in town, and then we have to go great distances. It flies us around. Okay, looks like David Ray's come up with something here. He says spread of cell phones in third world. All right, that is a good one, actually.
Yeah. And instead of having to lay lines, you know, telephone lines, which is very expensive, you know, and particularly in countries that are developing, to cover the cost of that, you know, you put up a cell tower and everyone gets their own cell phone, and so a lot of these places they basically have leapfrogged the old paradigm. They never adopted the old paradigm of a landline in the home. Instead, everybody just walked around with cell phones. Seems to work.
Absolutely. Well, David points out that this represents advances in infrastructure, education, availability, and technology, plus increasing living standards. Absolutely. It speaks to all of those things. And it's
He's really gunning for that coffee mug.
He's going for the coffee mug, but I think Matt's got some stuff he's getting ready to type. I can feel the tension here on this end of the keyboard that he's going to get his entry in here pretty quick.
Can I throw in another one while he's doing that?
Why, sure.
Okay. Chrysler had a hidden electric car program that they hid this thing well. You know, we've been talking about the Chevy Volt for I don't know since we came over to Blog Talk Radio about a year ago almost. We've been talking about the Chevy Volt, and come to find out, Chrysler has been working as hard as GM on their own line of electrical vehicles, and practically nobody knew about it. And it looks like they may be bringing out their EVs and range assisted EVs the same time as the Chevy Volt comes out. So I mean, this is huge news. This is I guess bad news if you're GM and thought you were going to leapfrog the market or bring something to market before anybody else. But
great news for the consumers.
That's right.
And for the market generally, because the more players, obviously, that's going to drive competition. That's going to drive the quality of the product. That's going to drive the speed at which they're forced to innovate and evolve these electric car technologies as they bring them to market.
That's right.
So what do we know about
them? Very cool.
What do we know about the Chrysler cars? How do they compare to the Volt? Are they plug-in hybrids also?
They have one sports car that's
all electric, baby.
They have one sports car that's going to be all electric, and then they have two other range-assisted models. One's going to be like a minivan, and one will be like a Jeep, like a four-door Jeep, with the ability to plug in. And now when I'm talking about range extended, it's different from a plug-in hybrid. We've talked about this a couple times on the show. Plug-in hybrid would be where the engine's actually attached to the drivetrain. These cars would have a small engine that charged the batteries as you go down the road. And so it's EV all the time, even when the gas engine's running, it's just charging the battery.
Right. Now that's the Chevy, right? Or is that
trying to shut up?
Well, it's both. It's the Chevy Volt is going to be that way, but the Chrysler vehicles that they're bringing out are going to be that way also. So
both of those then represent a real step forward from the Prius model, which was this kind of switching back and forth, not trying to be electric and using gas to support electric, but it was more of a do as much as you can with electricity and then use gas when you have to kind of a model for propulsion. Here we're saying we're using the gas to make the electricity when we have to, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So that is a big step forward. That's pretty freaking huge. Well, Stephen, I guess you know you're going for the coffee mug too here, huh?
I think I'm not in the running since I'm a co-host. So
we got to get
some more from the chat room.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll see if we get some more from the chat room. Meanwhile, let's consider the. David's idea about mobile phones improving life in the third world leads me kind of to the case against the better all the time argument. And I thought we might spend a few minutes on that. I had actually provided a link to you guys, and we can put this in the show notes, to an article by Peter Hitchens, and I believe he's Christopher Hitchens' brother, if I'm not mistaken. He's a journalist, and he's talking, his story is entitled How China Created a New Slave Empire in Africa, which is just a horribly depressing title. And what he describes there is basically an old-style imperialist power grab by China in Africa, talking about how you've got just unbelievably low pay and deplorable working conditions for the for people who are working for Chinese companies or for representatives of the Chinese government who've come in and set up contracts with the local African authorities and essentially have reduced many thousands of people to virtual slavery. And you look at things like that, and that's hardly an isolated incident. That one caught my attention today. It's hardly an isolated incident. You can look elsewhere in Africa and find many more examples of things that a person could look at and say, how, in good conscience, how can you be right in the head and argue that the world is getting better all the time when you see terrible developments like this, not only things that are wrong, but things that are maybe in some sense worse than they used to be. How can the world be getting better all the time if life is so horrible and possibly getting worse for some people?
Well, my response to that is that yes, bad things will continue to happen, and will continue to happen for a long time. We continue. What we do is we advance in a two-step forward, one-step back kind of way. It seems like we always seem like we are having setbacks here and there and everywhere, but our moves forward are more, or than the hits we take. This is cold comfort to the poor people that are basically in slavery to the Chinese in Africa, but as a whole, the world is moving forward, and the number of people that are in slavery or in servitude that would equate to slavery throughout the world, that number's got to be dropping. And I wish I could give you a sight on that. And I'm actually even looking through the Better All the Time book to see if there might be something that would deal with that. But I'm going to find a source for that, because I believe that is the case, that that slavery as a phenomenon in the world is decreasing over time.
I would like to see that one, because I sense that it's true. I certainly think that the number of people who are bought and sold as chattel slavery, as chattel slaves, that has definitely decreased over the centuries. That phenomenon has become anathema. It's socially unacceptable. Governments no longer will accept the idea of that, even though the practice still continues to a certain extent. But hand in hand with that, there's this idea of people essentially forced against their will to work in conditions that they would never have wanted to work in, to endure all kinds of hardships just to kind of eke out a living. And that's a hard number. That's a hard one to get your hand on. But I would suspect, and in fact, I am quite certain that the number of people and certainly the percentage of the overall population of the planet that are in those kinds of conditions has gone down. That there are fewer people who are forced to experience that kind of degradation and humiliation, and there's not enough bad words you can put on that. It's
that's right.
And as you say, it does the people who are suffering it right now very little good to hear that. Well, actually, there are fewer of you people experiencing this now than there used to be. That is of little comfort to them. But the fact that the trend is moving in that direction should be of astounding comfort to all of us, and should be of relevance to all of us, because we have to hasten the day when that is eliminated. And there's a couple things I would say about that particular story. One is that the fact that it's notable, the fact that that's news that you look at and go, oh, that's horrible in this day and age that those things are happening, tells you something about where expectations have moved in the world.
That's
and
right.
The fact that expectations have moved to that place in the world tells you that actually the world we expect is one that has improved dramatically from those kinds of things occurring. There's something else. At the beginning of the story, Hitchens describes the really harrowing scene where he and a couple other reporters are trying to get out of one of these camps because the people in it are like beating on the car. The people who work there want to pull them out of the car and kill them because the bosses have said, you know what's going to happen is these reporters are going to go tell people about this and they're going to close this place down and you're not going to get your money anymore. You're going to lose your job. So not to in any way defend the conditions that these people live under, the fact that they would feel threatened by that and that they would fight to actually protect that position that they have tells you that in some way those circumstances are better than the ones that they imagine they would have if that job wasn't there, which does not
and I suppose that they would know better than us what their position
exactly.
would be without that if you can call it a job. In starvation you do anything to avoid starvation. So, anyway, obviously, what's really needed is to build the infrastructure so that they can, have a real life there. But it's a long haul.
It's a long haul, and I think the fact that we're as horrified by it as we are indicates, to a certain extent, how intolerable to the world going forward this kind of thing is and must be, and I think that's probably the better all the time lesson that can be learned from looking at something like that. But I think your point is extremely well made. We're never arguing that life is always going to be happy for everybody.
Right.
The world is improving and our circumstances are improving, but it doesn't mean that disasters won't happen, that tragedies won't happen, or that people won't have terrible, painful, unhappy lives. Of course, all those things are continuing to go on, and we have never suggested otherwise. But that doesn't mean that the world isn't improving. The world isn't getting better all the time, and I think there's a strong case to be made, as we have pointed out in Better All the Time over the last few years, that in fact is happening. So this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're talking about how the world really is getting better all the time, and if you want to join us, you can give us a call at 347-215-8972 or join our online chat. Now, Michael, what's going on in the chat room? Any other ideas for how the world's getting better all the time since we took that little diversion?
The slavery thing induced an interesting discussion that came full circle to the mortgage guys, because I was observing that your report about China abusing some workers in Africa made me feel like maybe China was moving all their mortgage brokers to Africa. But I was kind of joking. And but Matt put up a good one. This article, he put the link in there, and I copied the headline, "New Way to Control Protein Activity Could Lead to Cancer Therapies." And if you read the article, which I scanned quickly, I put another line in there. The new technique could also speed to the development of therapies in which cancer-fighting proteins are selectively delivered to tumors. Wicked cool advance, and perhaps not quite as creepy as the I Am Legend scenario, but all the while, very interesting therapy. Not, I wouldn't say preventative. I don't see the trick there, but as a therapy after the fact, it looks pretty cool.
Very cool. And Matt notes that this research is going on in his hometown, so that's a nice local angle. Stephen, this sounds familiar. This might be further developments on something that we talked about previously on an earlier show, or maybe that you had written about that. It just sounds like something that we've talked about before, or am I imagining that?
This is not the same thing as the GIFT treatment, the granulocyte treatment. I don't think that's the same deal at all, is it?
I don't think it is. No, these are proteins. So maybe not. Maybe that's what I was thinking of. But off the bat, without having read that, you can see where you can see where proteins would be an extremely viable way of doing this, because they can can be reproduced, because they can get in there and you know, actively take something out. But you don't, as Michael points out, you don't have that virus going nuts, reproducing itself problem. Although viruses, proteins themselves can be dangerous. I believe that mad cow disease is a protein and not a virus. So we'll have to play carefully with whatever tools we're using to fight cancer, whether that be viruses, proteins, or nanobots. But that is a tremendously positive development, I would think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I mean, throw out another one. You hear about the 12-year-old kid who made a new and improved solar cell?
Did I read about that on a blog someplace? It seemed like I did.
Well, this one I wrote, so, you know, you probably did read it.
Tell us.
Okay, William Wan is his name. He's 12 years old, and he decides he's just wasting his childhood. So he looks at the 3D solar cells that have been developed and says, "Well, this is a good idea. You know, with the 3D solar cell, you are capturing more of the waves, the different you're absorbing different parts of the light so that you can get more power out of it." And he said, "Well, you know, but this can be improved." And so he came up with one, and I'll just read from it. William invented a novel solar panel that enables light absorption from visible to ultraviolet light. He designed carbon nanotubes to overcome the barriers of electron movement, doubling the light electricity conversion efficiency. William also developed a model for solar towers. That's when they're talking solar towers, they're not talking big, tall things. They're talking within the 3D solar panels, I believe, and a computer model optimize the parameters. His optimized design provides 500 times more light absorption than commercially available solar cells now, and 9 times more than the cutting-edge 3D dimensional solar cells that are in laboratories now. And my thought is that, you know, this is not a marginal improvement. If they can figure out a way to take these solar cells and manufacture them for a reasonable cost, it's a revolutionary, paradigm-shifting sort of development. The sort of thing that all of a sudden it becomes cheaper to put these things on your rooftop and get your electricity this way than getting it off the grid, which, when you reach that point, that changes things big time.
That is just an incredibly cool story. 12 years old, this kid comes up with this stuff. I mean, I look back on the kinds of things I was thinking about and doing when I was 12, and unfortunately, developing new world-changing technologies was not among them. At least not in a serious, disciplined kind of way. He obviously has access to a good deal of. I wonder what he does have access to. He's not actually trying to synthesize, build these materials himself. He's designing them, so he has.
Obviously, he has access to some tools that your typical 12-year-old does not.
Yeah,
but I mean, he's taking carbon nanotubes and creating better. You know, obviously, he's got some tools, but I mean, he's also got some. He's got a tool between his ears that the average 12-year-old doesn't have too. The kid's got to be a genius.
32-year-old doesn't have
yeah.
matter.
That's right. That's right. The kid's a genius.
Well, that's a great story. It's a very, very encouraging story. I hope we hear more from him, and I hope that something positive comes of this. You know, we talk about the becoming solar singularity, and we talk about rapid developments in solar energy. You think about big government agencies and big industries working on these developments. A kid who should be, you know, by age in the seventh grade, sitting and mapping out a huge step forward is not one of the scenarios I had envisioned. But I'm very pleased to hear that that's going on. It makes you think. Well, wonder where else big steps forward might be coming from.
That's right.
And speaking of doing things with advanced materials and also interesting places where new developments are coming from, did you happen to see the story about who's working on a space elevator?
I did. Japanese. Extremely cool. One of the things nearest and dearest to our hearts is the space elevator.
Yes, well, one of the reasons that I've awarded no points to either of the presidential candidates for the debate Friday night was There was no mention of a space elevator whatsoever, and it was already in the news that somebody is seriously working on this. So I'm hoping, you know, that one of them is going to step up and talk about this now that it's been introduced into the reasonably serious public discourse. This is another good example. We talk about the evolution of thinking around around pluripotent stem cells being produced from mature tissues. This was an idea that was just a few years ago radical and ridiculous, and now people are seriously doing it, and we're looking at it coming into widespread use. Space elevator is another example of that kind of thing. And
exactly.
This is an idea that I first had when I was like, I don't know, 15 years old, and I think I came up with it independently. I might have read it in Arthur C. Clarke or something like that, but I just had this idea, you know, we could save a lot of money if we just build a, you know, put something in orbit, and then you dangle a thing, and I actually had that idea. So, I was no 12-year-old prodigy, but that was an idea I had, and it has been for the last, you know, since someone first proposed it, somewhere just a little south of sheer fantasy, right? It's not an idea that has been, something like solar energy that has received a lot of serious attention.
Right.
Until all of a sudden it is an idea that's getting some serious attention.
And you know, when I was a kid back in the 70s, Phil, I read something that talked about, you know, what it would take to build a beanstalk. It says, how to build a beanstalk was the name of the article. Mm-hmm. And obviously it was referring back to the beanstalk that Arthur C. Clarke had envisioned. And it went through all the different metals and materials that were available, you know, industrial grade steel all the way up until, you know, and then it said, okay, here's what we really need. We need something that has these characteristics, and it called the material fictionite.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it actually had a tensile strength that's far beyond anything that we can envision even with carbon nanotubes, because they were imagining a beanstalk that was basically made of something that was as heavy as steel. And in order to have something that heavy that would reach into outer space, then obviously it's got to be stronger than we could ever even envision carbon nanotubes being. What we're thinking about now.
Carbon nanotubes being that they're much stronger than steel and also much lighter than steel.
He was envisioning a tower that looked like, like a antenna tower that goes into outer space or something. What we are envisioning now is a ribbon that's very thin. Made of carbon nanotubes that stretches in outer space.
Right.
Much lighter,
now,
obviously.
What the Japanese scientists on this consortium have said is that to get this thing going, we're going to need carbon nanotubes attached to a fixed platform in orbit, which extends to a base station on Earth. I should have explained that's the basic idea for anyone who's listening who doesn't know what we're talking about when we say space elevator. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about a fixed means of transport from Earth to space and back. You essentially attach a tether to a satellite in orbit, and then you can run something like an elevator car up and down that tether. Now, carbon nanotubes are the technology of choice for doing this because they're much stronger than steel, much lighter than steel. The thing is, right now, what is available in terms of carbon nanotubes suffers in terms of length. No one has made anything terribly long with carbon nanotubes to date, and of course these would have to be extremely long fibers to reach out into space. And the other issue is around strength. In order to do it, these carbon nanotubes would have to be about four times as strong as what we currently have. So that sounds like, wow, we got a long way to go. But the article points out that the strength of such materials has increased 100-fold in the past 5 years.
Amazing.
Yeah, so we don't have much farther to go, considering how far we've come, in order to have a material strong enough to provide a space elevator. We still got to figure out how to make it long enough, and of course there are 10,000 logistical issues that would have to be worked out in order to actually make this happen. But one of the major problems, fictionite, seems to have been solved.
That's right. It looks like we may have the fictionite we need. And like you say, other logistical problems, a big one is, well, how do you power the cars that go up and down this thing? And things like that. I mean, and obviously lots of things need to be worked on, but the fact that it's being seriously considered, and can you imagine, Phil, once we're able to break the gravity well without having to, basically get on a very dangerous explosive rocket ship and blast our way into orbit, that'll seem like the wild and woolly days of the space exploration once we have a space elevator.
It seems like once you have that space elevator, the true age of space can begin.
That's right.
Because you have this safe and so much cheaper, so much safer way of moving materials and people into space. I think that that's going to be a breakthrough unlike any that have come before in terms of the exploration of the universe. So we've got
right now, billionaires can spend $20-30 million and go into outer space for vacation. Normal people, after the space elevator is invented, normal people can get on the space elevator and go into outer space, and it'd be roughly, I'm just going to put out there that it'd be roughly a first class flight on a commercial airline. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, eventually you would get to that point, and then from there, with infrastructure up there, with actual settlement occurring up there, you have real possibility of people moving out into the planets, moving to the moon. Robert A. Heinlein, I believe it was, who said that low Earth orbit is halfway to anywhere. So if we can get a space elevator going, the rest of the universe becomes a lot more conquerable than it currently is, having to come out of this gravity well all the time. So it's a huge potential development, and the fact that that the Japanese government is seriously looking at it and seriously taking steps towards it, I think is extremely encouraging, and it's also a message to the U.S., to Europe, to China, now that they're such big players in space. Hey, get serious about this because others are, and it's time to take that idea seriously. So very excited about that one. And I see from the clock that we've actually exceeded our time just a bit, but that's what happens when you start talking about good news, because there's so much of it that you can hardly make it fit into 2 hours, much less 1 hour, which we tried initially. So why don't we move quickly on to talking about what our music is this evening?
Well, I mean, and I just want to add, Phil, we could do a part three next week because I've got a whole lot more.
I've got more too. Why don't we keep the contest going too? In fact, we'll have part three next week, and we'll double down. The winner is going to get a coffee mug and a mystery gift in addition to the coffee mug. So.
Well, considering the week that we've had in the worldwide financial markets, I thought I'd go back and look at what FDR said, that we have nothing to fear but fear itself.
Right.
In that spirit, I offer this song. It's James Castro's "Courageous."
All right.
Now you'll remember this is the same. I'm sorry. Go ahead, though.
I was just repeating "Courageous" by James Castro. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's the artist who performed "Awesome Alpharetta" that we had on the show a few weeks back.
Oh, right. Okay, so same artist. Now he's singing on the subject of courage, something that's very much needed to get through these troubling times. And also, I think it takes a certain amount of courage to take the position that the world's getting better all the time. But we need to take that position, and so we need to be courageous and do so. All right, Stephen, well, thank you very much for your contribution this evening. Michael, thanks to you and to our friends in the chat room for their great ideas about good news. Hope they'll join us next week, and we will put together more ideas for better all the time. Oh, you know what I just remembered, Stephen?
What's that?
Next week is our one-year anniversary for...
Yes. The one-year anniversary of moving to Blog Talk Radio. Now... We should tell people
course,
that
we've been doing the show longer than that. Yeah.
Yeah, we've been doing the show since 2005. May of 2005, we had our first episode of Fast Forward Radio. But I mean, we published it whenever we felt like it, kind of thing. Once a month for a while if we were doing good, and then sometimes we'd go 4 and 5 months before coming out with another episode. We've been doing it once a week for the last year, and kind of excited about that.
Absolutely. This is a landmark for us. So I think next week we'll probably focus on that anniversary somehow, but we can bring some better all the time good news in there as well, and we will also announce the winner of who has provided the best good news either in the chat room this evening or in comments to the show notes, which will be going up probably sometime this evening or tomorrow. So we'll look forward to being with you all next week for the big one-year anniversary special of Fast Forward Radio on Blog Talk Radio. Until then, good night. What would you do?